just so you make sure you're in the right place. This is session 505, From Traditional Formats to Digital Delivery, Visual Collections Sustained for Research in the Internet Age. We're going to start with Jerry Simmons. He's an archive specialist and cataloger. He has his BA from the University of Georgia and his MLS from Catholic University. From 1990 to 1999, he was the archives cataloger at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, and since 2000, he's worked as a team leader for authorities cataloging for the Archival Research Catalog at the National Archives and Records Administration in College Park, Maryland.
Thank you, Michael, and good morning, everyone. I'm doing my part to keep it weird and to keep it in the 70s this morning. DocAmerica is all about the 70s. This presentation is adapted from an article that I published recently in the Prologue Quarterly at the National Archives. So this is the story of DocAmerica, and we were in a period of years of war protests, years of peace rallies, far-out, funky, and groovy threads, day-glow colors, and plenty of smoke. Ah, the 70s. So often we connect these notions with those familiar old pop culture images that made their way into our homes via the rabbit ears. No one can really forget the one image I think that sticks with most people when they think of the pollution problem in the 70s of Iron Eyes Cody, the crying Indian, as he's more familiarly known, rowing his canoe up a polluted canal in between smoking factories and other debris in the water. With the well-known slogan, people start pollution, people can stop it. But what most Americans don't know was that there was an official and federally supported photo documentary project led by the Environmental Protection Agency to capture like images for the permanent record. What follows is a brief overview of the Environmental Protection Agency's DocAmerica project, its history, leadership, and images, most importantly, and the collection's life and journey over the years since the project's close in the late 1970s. It was actually pretty hard to figure out, even from the EPA records at National Archives, when the project officially ended. It began to fade sometime in the 1977 area, and by 1979 it was completely defunct. William D. Ruckelshaus, the first administrator of the EPA, announced the start of DocAmerica in November of 1971. Like the Farm Security Administration's photo documentary of the Great Depression, DocAmerica would be a landmark project and would result in a collection of over 20,000 plus photographs by its conclusion, taking rightful credit for the United States' first serious examination and realization of its rapidly decaying natural environment. With Gifford Dean Hampshire as project director and with a clear mission to pictorially document the environmental movement in America during the decade, photography started in January of 1972. And of course, this is going to be an image-loaded presentation. The images you see here are just some that I have picked to give an introduction. Folks living out of a bus. That photograph actually was taken in Texas. Roadside cleanup of litter somewhere in the area of Telluride, Colorado. And on the far right, the Union Camp paper mill just west of Savannah, Georgia. And this is one of the more popular images from the DocAmerica collection, a photograph by Chester Higgins taken in May of 1973 of an oil slick surrounding Liberty Island in New York Harbor. To speak with the lingo, DocAmerica was truly a snapshot of America in the 1970s, capturing the big issues in living color. On the top left, Eric Colonius, who coincidentally turned out, in my research, I found him living in Charleston, South Carolina, and he had been an intern, recruited as an intern for this project, and then was handed a camera just a few weeks after his arrival at the EPA offices and sent out on his own mission to take photographs. On the far right, in the upper right-hand corner, an interesting shot by Bill Gillette, from Colorado, May 1972, with interesting advertisements for the clean air that was still remaining in the Colorado area: ski, swim, hunt, fish, and breathe. And the one just past it, what's that funny stuff I smell? It's fresh air. And then in the lower left-hand corner, advertising land for sale in Marathon Key, Florida. DocuAmerica captured the nationwide crisis of pollution. The decay of the urban centers of the upper left-hand corner is of a neighborhood that no longer exists. It was at the end of the Logan Airport runway in Boston. On the far right, a rusted-out VW Beetle in Jamaica Bay in New York. Forests being cleared in Johns Island, South Carolina, to make way for new golf courses. And then one of the more typical images you'll see in DocuAmerica, if you were to actually skim through the entire 20,000-plus images, numerous shots of wildlife perishing on the shores of polluted creeks and rivers. It captured the controversy as well. There again, more wildlife languishing on the shores of polluted rivers. Other social issues of the day: wildlife endangerment, migrant labor, the drug culture, and beyond. In the very center, a photograph of a young woman enjoying a marijuana cigarette not too far from here in Leakey, Texas. It also captured the upbeat and the positive. We have a young woman displaying her I'm Clean bumper sticker after her car has passed an emissions test in Ohio. On the top right, quilters in South Central Nebraska displaying one of their handmade quilts. Two gentlemen in Fountain Square in Cincinnati grooving out apparently to some happening tunes, wearing some very interesting clothing. And then stuffed into the cab of the old yellow truck over there, balloons with the peace sign on them, and I believe an American flag somewhere in there, mixed in there. But it all, and also the downright creepy. Yeah, these two speak for themselves. The clown is a participant in the Aloha Day parade in Hawaii, and then on the bottom right, wig mannequins taken by Mark St. Gill in a rural Texas town. Under Gifford Hampshire's expert direction, the DocuAmerica photographers contributed the collective snapshot of America's environmental crisis, focusing on a set of guidelines developed by Hampshire himself and the EPA administration overall. A World War II veteran, degreed photojournalist, and self-taught student of documentary photography, Hampshire found himself working for the EPA administrator Ruckelshaus in 1971, very soon after it became its first, EPA became an agency. He proposed the DocuAmerica project to Ruckelshaus himself, and the project started almost immediately. According to Hampshire's own personal memoir, things happened in tight groups at the EPA in those early days, and all you had to do was pitch a very convincing project and the project would be approved and start almost immediately. In his own words, Hampshire describes his inspiration for ideas that soon became DocuAmerica. It was an exciting time. The public was expecting results. EPA had worked swiftly to close down the big offenders of industrial pollution, but industry was only one source of the problem. It became clear that on many fronts, people were responsible for much of the pollution issues. Fouling our own nest, we were the easy-come, easy-go society, the throwaway society, the society that was dependent on convenience goods without regard to its cost to our only world. Using a clear set of guidelines and mission points inspired by Rex Tugwell and Roy Stryker's Farm Security Administration project from the 1930s, Hampshire and his hand-picked photographers systematically recorded the ills of the early 1970s in America. This is a photograph loaned to me courtesy of the Hampshire family. Hampshire actually died in 2004. His wife and son and daughter still live in rural Virginia, out just west of Washington, D.C. And this is a photograph with Gifford Hampshire on the far right, but with the Farm Security Administration, well-known photographers and planners Arthur Rothstein and Roy Stryker then in the center. It turns out that Rothstein and Stryker actually lent consulting help to the DocAmerica project. So his guidelines for the DocAmerica photographers were geographic in nature, and each photographer worked generally in one specified area of the United States, and in many cases the general area of the country where that photographer lived. EPA purchase orders for the photographers detailed geographic areas to cover, occasionally mentioning specific subject matter and particular interest to EPA and to Gifford Hampshire himself. In January of 72, he started the new year by issuing the first series of guidelines for photographers, the first of which served as a working outline for a small group of initial DocAmerica photographers, several of whom recruited by Hampshire from contacts at the American Society of Magazine Photographers, his personal connections at the National Geographic magazine, and others like John Vashon, who had already worked on the Farm Security Administration project during the Depression era. His second guideline was to say simply this. Your secondary guideline is to look for pictures wherever you are, for whatever purpose, where you see people, there's an environmental element to which they are connected. The great DocAmerica pictures will show the connection and what it means. One of the more striking aspects of DocAmerica, as you move away from the non-personal shots of the landscape or rivers or mountains or other industrial areas, there's a tremendous amount of human effect that takes place in this collection. The human faces, I think, become one of the more profound and interesting stories of the overall DocAmerica collection. On the far right, a photograph by Eric Colonius with a woman holding a container of what would be drinking water from her farm well. And as you can see, even I think maybe from this distance, that it's, the water is almost entirely black. A photograph by Charles O'Rear in the very center with a statement on the war situation in Vietnam. This is in Beaver Crossing, Nebraska. Down here on the bottom, two photographs by Jack Korn. He was assigned to document the problems, health problems and other social issues in the West Virginia mining areas. And these are just two of the pictures of coal miners. One here, of course, being tested for black lung. And the top, a former resident of the Neptune Road neighborhood in Boston. I mentioned that earlier with the boy playing on the old burned out car. Neptune Road no longer exists. It was at one time a very vibrant and exciting neighborhood, probably very ethnic in its nature. But once the Logan Airport extended its main runway near Constitution Beach, the houses themselves started to rattle apart. The residents became sick with hearing problems, with nervous problems from the low-flying jets. Actually, the wheels of the jets would, as it appeared in the photographs, just barely clear the tops of their homes. And today, the Neptune Road neighborhood in Boston is just basically a big empty lot of construction equipment and a place to park spare school buses. It was, of course, a sweeping project as far as geography goes, the 48 states, all the way from Alaska, Hawaii, and all the way down to Puerto Rico. On the top left, a shot of western Maine, Key West, Hawaii, and then Alaska. This photograph on the bottom right is actually the point at which the planned Alaskan pipeline was going to cross this highway. And so this is a photograph of before the pipeline crossed the road. The photographers who populated the DocAmerica photographer pool have, many of them gone on now to very impressive photojournalism careers. On the bottom, Danny Lyon. On the far right, Bill Gillette, who still does a tremendous amount of environmentally oriented photography in the general Colorado and western areas. Arthur Tress, Charles O'Rear, by far the greatest contributor to DocAmerica, he's responsible for over 1,500 of the photographs in the collection, and he had some very amazing assignments, including all of Hawaii. I spoke with Mr. O'Rear last year when he visited the National Archives to see his photos after having not seen them for over 37 years. And I asked him how he got the choice of assignment of Hawaii, and he said, I think I was just lucky. And he said, clearly, anybody who participated in this project was very lucky. Up on the top left is actually a photograph of one of the photographers doing a DocAmerica assignment. This is David Heiser on assignment in the desert Southwest. And an assistant of his took this photograph with the camera that he had been using already as a National Geographic photographer. So almost immediately, they recognized the popular potential of the DocAmerica collection. And as fast as they could, they prepared small but very meaningful exhibits for the general Washington, D.C. area. As the photographs started to roll in, they were cataloging them in a special system that Gifford Hampshire had prepared himself. Recently, one of his friends told me that he devised a system of two slide projectors, one slide projector to project the image onto a screen and a second slide projector to carry a caption from a fiche reader. So when he rolled through the carousels of the DocAmerica photographs, you could see the image and then the caption and the photographer information at the same time. These, again, I apologize for the size of the photographs. These are snapshots loaned to me by the Hampshire family. Up on the top left, we have Gifford Hampshire giving a brief tour to Bill Ruckel's house. Of course, he was the first EPA administrator, and to Tom Hart, an EPA staffer. And this is just an exhibit that was thrown up very quickly in the hallways of EPA in Washington, D.C. On the lower one, you see a DocAmerica exhibit roughly around the time of 1973. And in this photograph, you have some large names, I think. S. Dillon Ripley from the Smithsonian. Russell Train, who was the second administrator for the EPA and who is still with us and kindly gave me an interview last year. He works for the Nature Conservancy now. Ann Doerr in the background there, who is in the PR department, of course, Gifford Hampshire, giving direction to the tour on the right. So it can be said that when you think of DocAmerica, you would think naturally it's all crisis. Everything was depressing. Everything was run down. It was quite bleak. This is a photograph in the bottom center. Is one of a poverty-stricken Mulkey Square neighborhood in Kansas City. This was another neighborhood that perished completely due to progress, as we would call it. The entire neighborhood around Kansas City was leveled for a new interstate interchange to be built over the next few years following the snap of this photograph. On the far right is actually a mesa and a cut-through that was not natural. This is a result of strip mining. It was a photograph taken by Eric Colonius. Over on the left, a photograph taken by Charles Steinhacker. Steinhacker's area of assignment was Maine and New Hampshire, and this is industrial waste being poured directly into the Androscoggin River in Maine. And in the top center, there's one of those photographs that you just can't imagine is even real, that it looks like two images pasted together somehow in a Photoshop, that the residents of Neptune Road in East Boston were this close to the landing gear of large aircraft as they approached Logan Airport. But then, of course, we have images of the positive. One of Charles O'Rear's, in addition to his assignment in Hawaii, he was also sent to what was called the healthiest place in the United States, Jefferson, I think, in Jackson counties, almost immediately west of Lincoln, Nebraska, for some reason had the highest rate of good health. There were no heart problems, no high blood pressure problems, and he was sent there to take snapshots of a way to interpret this this phenomena. I asked Mr. O'Rear, I said, well, what was the answer then? What did you find there? And he said, nothing more than people living hardy, well-worked lives on farms, activities, this sort of blurry swirl picture is a photograph he took of a square dance hoedown just west of Lincoln, Nebraska. And one of the farmers that he said actually pulled a gun on him and asked him to leave his property before he had a chance to explain why he was there to take pictures of this huge abundance of chicken eggs he had just collected. And then the exhibit on the road. Shortly after the smaller exhibits started to overflow the hallways of EPA, and Gifford Hampshire realized immediately that he was not in the business of traveling exhibitions or being a photo curator for exhibitions, he was able to acquire the help of SITES, of the Smithsonian Institute's Traveling Exhibitions Program, and they produced a traveling exhibit of the photographs and moved it around the country quite a bit, in addition to preparing a few weeks standing exhibit at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And these are some of the photographs that were in that initial exhibit at the Corcoran before it went on the road with SITES. Thanks to my co-presenter, Marisa Burgoyne, who former archivist at the Corcoran, who helped me figure out the curatorial ins and outs of this exhibit. And I wanted to just point out one of the curators at the Corcoran described this photograph on the bottom, which is of Lake Tahoe. Lake Tahoe in May 1972, described by a Corcoran curator as unknown kind of crap on the water. So DocuAmerica begins to fade in the late 70s, around 77. Interest becomes hard to drum up for Gifford Hampshire. He begins to struggle with budget problems. Nothing, no shock there. And the whole project begins to wind down in the late 70s. After things wrap up at the EPA, he strikes a deal with the Center for Creative Photography at the University of Arizona, and the entire collection of the paper records, the slides, the transparencies, the microfilm, everything is packaged up and sent to Arizona. But wait. Someone realized that these are really federal records, and a short 16 months after they went to Arizona, they came back to Washington, D.C. immediately, accessioned in April of 1981 at the National Archives in downtown for a while, and now their permanent home is at the College Park facility. In a digital planning effort in the late 90s, all of the DocuAmerica photographs that were a part of the official collection, this is around 15,900 photographs, were digitally scanned and processed and eventually cataloged in the Archival Research Catalog, which is called ARC. You can find it on NARA's website very easily. We also have prepared numerous galleries. You'll see along the bottom these buttons along the bottom. The special topics is actually a special art gallery area where we've grouped photographs by their subject matter for easy use by educators and students. So we've got things, sort of a small online exhibit feature that way. The latest step in DocuAmerica's trip, I am very excited to say, is Flickr. In mid-July this year, the National Archives initiated its photo stream on Flickr, and the first photographs to go were some of the DocuAmerica photographs, I'm very excited to say. This photograph taken by Charles O'Rear, May 1972, somewhere near Toppat, Arizona, on U.S. Route 66. When I first started doing the research and I found this photograph, and this has been used in several presentations as I call this guy the poster child for DocuAmerica because his image is everywhere, and you can really understand why. The tank top with the faded USA on it, the patchwork jeans, carrying the dog. I really can't tell if that's a red bandana around the dog's neck or not. I don't have a clear enough photograph. But when I contacted O'Rear, I said, please tell me this is a photograph of you on the road working for DocuAmerica. He said, no, sadly, this is a gentleman that I met on Route 66. He never gave me his name. He only gave me the dog's name. The dog's name is Tripper. So as of last night, we have 1,166 of these DocuAmerica images on our Flickr photo stream, and we have enjoyed 44,927 hits on these photographs since July 16th. So I invite everyone to take a look at Flickr. The Doc America photographs will continue to appear there every week. We're loading hundreds more every week. And take a look, add your comments, add your tags, and contribute your own effort to the Doc America project. So thank you very much. I'm sorry.
Also, can everyone see? You can move closer if you need to. It's like the largest screen I've ever seen. Up next is Marisa Burgoyne, who's the Richard Minugian Chief of Reference Services at the Archive of American Art at the Smithsonian Institution. Marisa earned her master's degree in library science from the University of Maryland, and as Jerry mentioned, was previously the archivist at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Good morning. Here we are in the death slot. I appreciate everybody coming out this morning. The picture you just saw was my son playing hard to get, which he really shouldn't do. In follow-up to Jerry's really fantastic presentation about a specific project, I'd like to take a broader view of what reference service is like at an institution that deals heavily with visual materials, but not exclusively. The Archives of American Art collects papers of individuals and records of organizations. This includes all kinds of materials that you'd expect, but focuses primarily on the visual arts, including painting, sculpture, drawing. The things that we don't collect include architecture, except when we do, and performance art, except when we do. And as a result, our more than 8,000 collections have a rich, fantastic body of material that's available to scholars and other folks. We talk about who uses the Archives of American Art. I like the Saul Steinberg picture a lot because it sort of hints at the fact that oftentimes we don't know who's using our collections unless and until they fill out one of our forms. The Archives of American Art is a small unit of the Smithsonian Institution. It was founded separately from the Smithsonian in the 1950s in Detroit by a curator and a collector who felt that access to documents in the history of American art weren't readily available. And they engaged in a project to start microfilming materials held in repositories around the country and make them available through a microfilm lending program. The program was very successful. The Archives of American Art would go out and borrow things from people to film and then give them back. And eventually people started to say, well, why are you giving this back to me? I don't really have space for it in my barn or my attic or my basement anymore. Why don't you just hold on to it? So the archives gradually, really actually from the very beginning, began to collect original materials as well. And in some cases, the microfilm is a total snapshot of what's in the collection, and sometimes it's parts. We know there are at least two instances where we borrowed collections for microfilming, returned the materials to their owners, and in one case, the guy's barn burned down and the materials are lost, so we now have the only surviving record of that material. But from the beginning, our main users were art historians, and the discipline of art history was fairly new in the 1950s and 1960s. People had been focusing primarily on European art, but as materials became more available, more people started to use them, people started to deposit things. The archives did a really great job of introducing its materials to scholars. And gradually, we have scholars working in other disciplines, working on our materials. Artists love to come to the Archives of American Art. I think they like to come to see what other people are saying about them. They really get excited when they find, you know, materials in the archives that have to do with them, which is understandable. Students, curators, art dealers who are working on provenance, and the general public. And the general public is sort of what I want to talk a little bit about today, because that's been the biggest area of increase for us in the last few years. In the good old days, or in the not so good old days, everybody wrote letters. Not so much anymore. I think everyone's had pretty much the same experience. If you have a website, if you have an email address, people send you email. They don't send you letters anymore. I'm just going to talk about three ways that we handle digital collections, digital reference work, and then talk a little bit about our plans. I like this picture a lot also. It's the family gathered around the computer getting ready to send its Christmas card. The dog especially at the bottom I think is really pretty adorable. The first thing I want to talk about is our Ask Us form, which is online. It's your sort of standard fill-in box. We do ask people to choose their occupation at one point, and it includes some standard fields like teacher, undergraduate, scholar, museum curator. We also use this form to ask people to give us notice for appointments. It's a pretty old school kind of form. It was developed a long time ago and hasn't been updated in some time, but it still functions for us. It has been in use for several years, and as they say, people request appointments through the form. Most of the queries that we get from the public originate in this form by huge margins. 99% of what we ask, of what we answer, comes through this form. It does not have a random question filter on it. We have not been able to build a random question filter yet. If anybody has one, a plug-in, some open source, that would be fantastic. And by random question, I mean this kind of thing. Can you read this, or would you like my dramatic reading? You can read it? Okay. You want my dramatic reading? Okay. Oh my God, please help me. I work at a dumpy little hotel. The owner's wife doesn't know much about much and is not the nicest person. Today I come in. The maid has cleaned a room the people left. There is a painting in the office from the cleaned room. The maid says the owner's wife wants it. I look and look at it, knowing a little about a little. I love art, beauty. I'm a poet. The painting is real. On the bottom it says, the Catherine Lorillard Collection, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The painting has not a name, but letters and plus signs on the left side. It is dated 1880. It is a duet, a young couple running, holding some kind of material in each hand, creating a flowing cover over their heads. The girl is in a sheer gown. Her body is almost blue-like, it's so white. She has thin legs, but her belly is a little round. I think it was saying she was young. It's breathtaking, but I believe it's been stolen. I'm afraid my boss is going to be furious at me, but she simply cannot take it home. It belongs somewhere to someone. It pains me. You can reach me if you have info so I can tell her and we can call the police. I took some college, but I don't remember the artist. If you know, let me know. Thank you. So there really isn't any indication in this email why this person got to us. We oftentimes, when we get this kind of request, particularly for images, we'll do a little Googling around to see if we can figure out how people hit our page and our form. And I never really figured this out. What she's talking about is this picture, which I'm happy to report is still firmly in the grasp of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They have it. It's theirs. What seems most likely is that the woman if she was in California, she saw a print of the picture lying around a motel room and decided that it had been stolen. My approach to these kinds of questions is to answer completely straight. Just, thank you very much for your inquiry. The original painting is actually in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and so on. I do not write, well, for private use, I might write an answer like, yes, the Tong gang of your area has stolen this painting. They were trying to fence it from your motel. They got spooked, but they had to go out for cigarettes and beer. When they got out of the hotel, they noticed a surveillance camera. They fled the state, leaving the painting behind. Do with it what you will. I don't write answers like that because it's not respectful and people really want help, clearly. And it sort of illustrates the difficulty in dealing with visual materials. The woman, somehow she got to our page, and I'd still like to know how, but she didn't have the tools to do a kind of image search that might help her drill down into the Metropolitan Museum of Art collection and find this image, and thus maybe perhaps get her to sleep better at night knowing that it hadn't been stolen. So we do handle a lot of questions about materials that don't have anything to do with us. The other way that we deliver material to people is through our search images database. There are more than 8,000 images in the database, and one can do an item-based search on that particular item. And these are items in larger collections. These are not it's not a collection of images that you're seeing. It's one particular image, one particular item out of a collection. Images are added to the database in a kind of ad hoc way as a result of scanning requests for internal use, for exhibitions, for external requests. And many of our rights and reproductions follow-up questions come from people having found search images. This is our search images box with a little description of what you can find here. And on the right-hand side, You can browse through the images based on some topics. But if you go to, if you put in, for instance, Jackson Pollock, and you get 88 items that match Jackson Pollock. And again, these are from all kinds of different collections at the Archives of American Art. Most of them probably do come from the Jackson Pollock papers. But as an example, this is the search result that you'd get. And I just picked the first one because I thought it was fantastic. Pollock family eating watermelon in Arizona, circa 1914. The image presents with its cataloging data on the left-hand side, and your search terms are highlighted, and on the left side you get a thumbnail of it, and if you click that you get the big picture, which is, I think, pretty fantastic. It says, in the good old watermelon time, and there, I think, is on the... At the top, you see the caption information again. This information also includes a digital ID number, and that's the number that people use to request reproductions. When they wish to use the picture again for publication or research, you'll notice, I hope you can see, that this image that's presented on the website is watermarked. You can capture the image and you can use it for what you want, but for your private research use, but if you'd like to publish it or use it anyplace else, you'd have to deal with a watermark, which means you'd have to deal with us. So search images, as I say, is an item-level thing. Collections online is our big, fantastic achievement with which I have nothing to do. So I can't do anything except encourage you to go to the next session, which is going to include one of our staff members talking about it. But to give you a brief overview of collections online, the Archives of American Art received a Terra Foundation grant to digitize entire collections. And the goal is, I think, about 105, and at my count, 75 or so are now available online. The technical aspects of it, the planning, are really a presentation unto themselves. And I will say again, it's a tremendous achievement that I'm very, very proud to be a part of. Patrons are using this in pretty significant numbers, but we don't generally hear from them in the reference department unless they have a problem. This is our collections online screen. On the left-hand side are things that have been recently added, and you get a little introduction to things on the right-hand side. And it does note, as this makes me very happy as a reference person, that most of the archives collections are not, in fact, presented this way, that most of what we have has not been microfilmed and has not been digitized, but there are a select number of collections that have. And this is based on a priority list that was developed with the input of the curatorial department and other departments before my arrival at the archives, but it's a fantastic list. This is the front screen for the Henry Oswalda Tanner papers, which have been digitized fairly recently. And you'll note at the top an introduction to the scope of the material, a paragraph talking about the scope of the material, some of its contents, the credit line for the Terra Foundation. And I'll say again, the Terra Foundation has been incredibly generous, and I think that their generosity is being repaid in ways that they might not have expected. The Archives of American Art is really pushing to have this process turn into a model for other repositories when they want. We're not going to impose it on anyone, mind you, but the material is presented based on the finding aid, and so here we have series one. Again, what you'd expect to find in a finding aid and formatted that way, but you'll see the hot links. The hot links will take you to the images which are presented in a viewer, and I would really encourage you to go to our website and have a look and see how it works. It's really tremendous. So the effect, I don't think that's the word I wanted. I think I wanted the E word. See, this is why you see things really big. They stand out. So again, I've just given you a very quick overview of what we're doing in terms of digital delivery of the Archives of American Art. And there have been some effects on the reference department. The reference department is myself, Wendy Herlock-Baker, who handles our rights and reproductions exclusively, Tessa Vizi, who does mostly interlibrary loan, Elizabeth Botten, who works with me on answering questions and sort of running the department, and we have a front desk person named Margaret Zoller, who manages our microfilm room. One of the things that we've noticed immediately is that access to our images and to our collections online has broadened our user base. And this is, of course, not new to anybody. But it was brought home to me in a particular way the other day when we had a family arrive for a manuscript reading room appointment. Now, this is unusual for us. We're still fairly specialized. We get scholars. We get art history types. We're not really used to families arriving for research appointments. And I was a little concerned because I thought maybe the gentleman who'd made the appointment expected to bring his wife and his 2-year-old into the reading room. Now, I love children. I have 2 of them myself, but they don't really belong in a reading room. And I was a little concerned, and I went up to him, and I said, you know, we're so happy to see you. The room is about to be opened. And he said, great. And I said, can we make your family comfortable in some way? He said, no, they're going to hang out here, and I'll go in the room, and I'll look at my great-grandfather's papers, because he had come to see, not as an art historian, but to see some genealogical material. And that was fine, so we set the little girl up with some coloring paper, and they had a nice day. But one of my staff members came up to me, and she said, that's only the second time I've ever seen a family come in to the reading room, and I've been here for 10 years. She said, I've never seen this before, and it's now happened twice in the last year. And I said, it's because digital access to our materials has allowed people who were just doing family history to come across our collections, having no other access point to us, and here they are. That experience was much better than the first family that we had about a year ago who the mom cried at me when I told her she couldn't bring her pre-adolescent children into the reading room. It was very sad. I've never had anybody cry at me, ever. So our usage has increased both in person and remote. We've had a 50% increase in electronic research requests between 2004 and 2009, and no corresponding increase in staff. In 2004, we handled about 2,000 research requests, and now we're handling about 3,000 a year. We have had a similar jump in the number of rights and reproductions requests that we're handling, and in terms of image delivery, this is where we're seeing, really where we're seeing the effect. With the digital ID numbers available in our search images collections, and with the collections online, people can really drill down to exactly what they want. We see more photo researchers than we used to. Our collections weren't really very well known by photo researchers. So we're getting requests to have our images appear in things that are not strictly art historical. We will never be lonely. The digital delivery of images will not make our jobs obsolete. People will always want to see the originals if they're working on publications or exhibitions. We have what I like to call the piece of the one true cross. People like to come in. They like to see stuff. They like to feel stuff. They want to turn it over. They want to hold it up to the light. They want to look at it. They want to figure out how it's going to look in their book or in their exhibition case. And so the reference department, although, as I say, we see a lot of our patrons' needs being met online, they're always going to want to come in and view us. And in addition to that, the online resources that we have often lead us to collections that aren't online or on microfilm since most aren't. And that's always interesting to see the chain that people make between a collection that they've seen online. They've made some connections with other topics of interest that we might have papers for, and they end up in our reading room. And finally, the expertise of our reference staff is still useful to researchers. And although I've been at the archives for more than 2 years, I feel like I only know a fraction of what I'm going to at the end of my career there, you accumulate a body of knowledge about collections and help people make those connections that are so important. So we feel, although we're doing a really great job in delivering visual resources to our patrons, that we're not going to be out of work unless the government says we're going to be out of work. And as I say, it is. There are a lot of things that are coming up next for us. We're working on some Web 2.0 applications. We're working on blogs. We're working on a web redesign. One of my colleagues is working on usability studies, and I'm hoping to be able to report about those studies at an upcoming conference. The Terra project will continue for the next few years. The target is to have 100 collections available online by the time that the project is done, and we're on track for that. I think we're also privately hopeful that we'll be able to continue producing that kind of material. I should also acknowledge Erin Corley is in the audience today, and she's one of the key staff members with the Terra project and can speak about it if we have some questions. And I just sort of like to close with this page from the diary of Clay Edgar Spohn, who in May 5th, 1969, made a note in his daily journal that he wanted to make sure that his papers went to the Archives of American Art, which is nice, because they did. And it's about, do this for the future of, do this for the future of conversation so that they might know something about artists and artists. So Clay Spoon, probably when he wrote this note in 1969, couldn't imagine a day where this could be projected on in a screen, having a digital image of it available online to anybody who wants to see it. But that's the idea that we're all working towards, that we're making these materials available to both our core user group and a wider range of scholars. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has any questions for Jerry or Marisa, feel free to ask them. I'm going to repeat your question because this, as you know by now, is being recorded. The other option is that you're welcome to come up and use the microphone. Any questions? The question is whether or not the people who live on in the Neptune Road neighborhood in Boston were compensated for the destruction of their property.
The records that exist out at College Park, of course, are only administrative records for DocAmerica. While doing my initial research project on the collection, I was immediately taken by the photographs of the planes landing so close to the homes, and I really did want to know more about it. I was able to find a few newspaper articles from that time period from the Boston area talking about the controversy. The folks trying to get some kind of help from the city government or the airport administration to help them with their medical bills and to repair their homes, but it turns out that most of them just ended up giving up and leaving. From what I could tell, no official help for the residents of that area. And like I say, now it's basically a big flat area just at the end of the Logan Airport runway, where they store construction. I mean, as you all, anyone has flown in and out of Logan Airport any time over the past 15 to 20 years, it is a perpetual construction project, and it gets bigger and bigger. And now Neptune Road is just a lot where they keep the extra bulldozers and dump trucks, it seems.
Any other questions?
I meant the lower 48, Alaska, Hawaii, and then additional photographs of John Vashon, who had been a photographer for the Farm Security Administration Great Depression Project, actually was sent to Puerto Rico to cover that area. And strangely enough, from the correspondence between Vashon and Gifford Hampshire that we have at College Park, Gifford Hampshire actually ended up firing Vashon. He said his photographs were disappointing for someone who had been a part of the Great Depression Project. And although I looked at Vashon's photographs myself, and I think it's interesting to see what most consider now to be a tropical paradise and a vacation hub and a huge tourist mecca in the Caribbean, some really startling photographs of industry too close to the water, uncontrolled and open dump, open landfills and garbage dumps. It was rather startling for Puerto Rico.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the conference and your trip home.